It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Thanks for joining me for the 46th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. This week is the first in a series of occasional podcasts that will deal with themes or subjects that I think deserve covering. Every once in a while, it's good to break up the regular weekly format and do something a little different, and that's what we're doing this time. We're going to discuss Watchmen, and I have two of my favorite cohorts with me, Ian Cullen and Gianluca Glaser. We'll look at Watchmen from several different angles. That's been a big topic of discussion for a while now. Since we've got a lot to get to, let's get on with the show. Okay, let's talk about Watchmen. And with me to do that is Ian Cullen. How are you, Ian?
I'm fine. I am going through the streets, discarding the filth and the hookers and the hoes, and I think we should just let them die.
Okay, he sometimes thinks he's Rorschach, so we can't go against that. And Gianluca Glaser, how are you, Gianluca?
I'm doing okay. Sorry.
Okay. Well, you don't do impressions, apparently.
No, not today.
Okay. To get started, we'll talk about the comic, the original comic. And a lot of people say, mistakenly so, that this is the greatest trade paperback that was ever made. Watchmen did not come out as a trade paperback. It came out as a limited series, 12 issues. It ran in 1986 to 1987. Of course, it's written by Alan Moore, and it was drawn by Dave Gibbons. And it's been reprinted in multiple versions and multiple trades and hardcovers, and there's an ultimate version.
Yeah,
I have the ultimate version. I can't bring myself to open it up, though. That's the terrible trouble. The way that Watchmen got started was that Alan Moore approached DC Comics about doing a tale about the recently acquired Charlton Comics characters. And I'm going to do a quick comparison of those real shortly here. Dick Giordano, who was the editor at the time, because they just got these properties, and once he got through with them, and if you know the story of the Watchmen, you know that they would basically be shredded and wouldn't be usable at that point. So he said, go ahead and make new characters somewhat similar, or they wouldn't sue him, because they wanted him to tell his story. It starts out in 1940s and 1960s, and it gets into the 1980s. The Vietnam War weighs heavy in the story. You hear talk about the Soviet Union. The way that you know that this doesn't take place in our reality is that Richard Nixon is elected to a third term, and you've got other things, of course, superheroes along the way, and various things happen that let you know this isn't our real world, that this is the Watchmen universe. Unlike, even like the DC universe was nothing like this, so it's its own continent. So it's really good. And it came out, and I was one of the ones that read it when it came out on a monthly basis. And it was such a great story, and I want to get into some of that. But why don't we start out with you, Gianluca, and why don't you tell me what jumps to mind when we talk about The Watchmen?
Sure, absolutely. Just a few things. One thing was that in between the chapters, there's these newspaper articles that kind of like explain to what happened to the original Minutemen characters, shows how, with the superhero craze going on, how a lot of people jumped in on it for publicity type of reasons, trying to become famous. You get such information about what happened to the Silhouette character, or even maybe hints at what may have happened to certain characters like Hooded Justice. It definitely fleshes out the characters in the story. It's really good. I mean, it just adds to the overall quality of the work. The other thing that I like about it is the squid monster. that is a common enemy that unites everybody, as opposed to being in a Cold War, unites Russia and the United States with a common enemy. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not quite an original idea. It's based, I believe it is, I believe Alan Moore probably based it off of the Outer Limits episode called The Architects of Fear, starring Robert Culp. Mm-hmm. That involved a group of scientists who created this monster, had it come crashing down on Earth to simulate a spaceship from another planet coming down to invade Earth. So it is an interesting concept. Great book overall, though.
Did you read it in the trade first?
I did.
Okay. So your perspective is a little different, because when you read a trade, like, for example, when I read Ronin, I had never read Frank Miller's Ronin until I got it in the collected format. And there was gaps in between Ronin, and there were like 6 to 8 months in between some issues. And so when I read it, I was like, well, of course this is a great book. What's the problem? And my brother was saying, well, you read it all at one time. The rest of the world was sitting there waiting for the next issue to come out, months and months away. I think you have a different perspective when you read that. Not a bad one, but definitely a different one. Absolutely. Now, Ian, how about you? Did you read it in the trade first?
I've only ever really read it in trade because I wasn't really getting comics regularly in the 80s when it came out. So the first time I read it really was a couple of months prior to seeing the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that stuck out for me is you had this other comic book wedged into it, you know, about pirates.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was wedged into it. And if anything, that's something I really didn't like about it.
Really?
It broke up the story and it took away from the flow of the story for me every time it went to that.
Yeah, that's called The Tales of the Black Freighter. Is what that part is. Ian, you and I were talking about before we started recording, was that this was an interesting thing. I was wondering, why did this take place? And of course, the internet, which of course is never wrong, is the reason why that's in there is because they wanted to have one of the kids reading a comic. And since superheroes are real in this universe, they wouldn't be having superhero comics, they felt. Instead, they would do something else. So Gibbons suggested a pirate theme, and Moore agreed because he's a fan of pirate stories. The Black Freighter alludes to a song called, and I probably, it's called Pirate Jenny is the anglicized version of it. And he enjoyed putting that of objects of fear, loathing, action, and the superhero books just wouldn't make it compared to that. They had to have something that was different from that, and that's why that was put in there. I agree that when I would get to those parts, very often I would skip over those, particularly the first time I was reading. To this day, I still don't understand where they fit into the storyline as to be something of a distraction to fill pages and stuff like that. So that was the part I agree was the weakest. It's no surprise in the movie that they didn't do that, but you can buy a version of the movie that has that integrated into it. You can buy it separate, you can buy a part of it, so it's not completely out of the Watchmen mythology going forward, but I never understood why that was in there, to be frank. It still doesn't hold up much for me. I thought real quickly what I would do is go down the different characters and tell which ones of the Charlton books they were modeled after, originally supposed to be. Edward Blake, who's the comedian, was supposed to be the peacemaker. Peacemaker was the guy who I always refer to as the guy with the toilet seat on his head. He's got this white helmet that just looks like a toilet seat put up, and he runs around with a gun. He's very much of something of an assassin, something of a person who goes around and fights characters. Dr. Manhattan's really obvious, particularly these days if you buy the New 52. Captain Atom is who Dr. Manhattan was supposed to be, and what's ironic is in the New 52, Captain Atom is like Dr. Manhattan. So it's kind of come full circle on that, which I find interesting. Of course, Night Owl is Blue Beetle, even to the fact of having a beetle craft instead of Archie the Owl craft. And it's pretty clear what was going on with that. And also the fact that he was a next-generation hero, which is what happened to the Blue Beetle. Ted Kord was the second-generation Blue Beetle, so he was a very different character. Ozymandias was based on Peter Cannon Thunderbolt. And he was one of the popular characters that they kept trying to turn into a TV show. And it never really worked out for him, but he was very much of a smarter, faster, stronger person than the average person. So you can kind of see that in Ozymandias. Now, Rorschach was clearly the question, even to the fact that the face is different. But rather than having just a blank face, which is what the question had, he had the Rorschach symbols that changed on his face as he spoke or as he moved around. So that was something a little different. So it wasn't really obviously the question. And the Silk Spectre is Nightshade. She has superpowers in the Charlton continuity. She's like Night Girl, or she can throw darkness around or things like that, or she's stronger in the darkness. But she ended up being much more like Black Canary or Phantom Lady than she ever ended up being Nightshade. Other characters were in there too, but those were the main ones who were based on the Charlton characters. So, as far as the artwork goes, Ian, what was your impression of Dave Gibbons' art in the series?
Very 80s.
Yeah.
But one thing that he did do, I mean, in The Watchmen, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Watchmen, it was the first time you've seen it. He worked out so you had 9 panels per page.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the first time that was actually done.
I don't know if it was the first time, but it became popular after that. Keith Giffen was notorious for using those 9-frame pages over and over again. He would do that in a book so they could make something happen with some break in between it. But how about you, John Luca? What did you think of his art?
I enjoyed it, actually. To me, it doesn't seem so dated. It's definitely like an 80s style. But there's like a lot of attention to detail and stuff like that, to where I don't really feel like I'm reading a dated comic. I really feel like it's more dated in terms of the whole Cold War thing going on, you know, between the Soviet Russia and the U.S. That to me kind of dates it more, and having Richard Nixon, even though it's an alternative reality, having Richard Nixon as president kind of dates it to me more.
Mm-hmm.
He's been long dead.
Right. The one thing I was going to ask about is, oftentimes in the comics, they won't have real-life politicians. They'll do it occasionally, and there's famous examples of that. Like, for example, Superman goes to visit JFK or other people. But most of the time, you don't have real-life politicians appearing in comics. That's because you don't want to alienate. Let's say you're a Democrat, and you pick up this book, and it's got Nixon in a positive light. You know, you don't want to alienate that person. I don't want to read that. That's nothing like reality.
Right.
Was that good for the book? Do you think it was bad for the book? What do you think, John Luca?
Yeah, it's funny, too, because around the same time you had The Dark Knight Returns, Frank Miller's mm-hmm. book, and that had Ronald Reagan mm-hmm. talking with Superman at the time. Mm-hmm. I think it was an interesting compliment. But, yeah, to me, it kind of does. It's like my least, you know, for you guys, it's the Black Freighter. For me, it's the fact that you have Nixon as a character there. Mm-hmm. I would have been happy with some generic artificial person created, something like that. Or if they wanted to go with Reagan again, it would have made more sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's interesting about that is, and this is getting off topic slightly a little bit for a short while, but in the last run of Captain Britain, we had former Prime Minister Gordon Brown pop up in the first issue.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
That's a British politician that no one in the States had heard of, apparently.
No. I know, right. Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that was really interesting about The Watchmen was that it went places we had not seen comics go in America in the past. We did not see heroes who functioned from a gray perspective. I mean, Superman was moral and righteous, and everybody was a hero. Never would dream of doing something that was questionable in nature. You have the raping of Miss Jupiter by the comedian, and that was so stunning. I mean, in the 80s, everybody was just gripped because we'd never seen this kind of thing before. It was adult in one sense, in that it made it that really these were some of the earliest books that really you wouldn't want to have children picking up and looking over because of that. I thought that was something that was really interesting about it. There were other things that were fascinating about the book was that we get to see the heroes actually can't be heroes by the end of it. When they get to the end and the solution is presented to it, and of course this is such an older book, we don't have to worry about spoiling it, but when it becomes obvious that by shutting up, they make things better for the whole world, groups before that would never have agreed to such a thing. People were much more like Rorschach. If something was not the truth, you had to go out there and push to get the truth out there, and consequences be damned. But this was the first time when we saw heroes who actually realized that not telling the truth was the better thing to do in this. And there were so many people who just wretched about that. What kind of heroes are these? These aren't the real heroes. But the interesting thing now, 20, 30 years later, that's a very common thing. We're used to that now, but this was the very first time we'd seen those kind of concepts introduced into comics. I just wondered if you guys had any comments about that. How about you, John Luca?
Absolutely. I was blown away reading The Watchmen. It really did change because everything I read was so simplified. The most complex you had was Batman as a character who dealt with the death of his parents. But the scenes in Mars, where Dr. Manhattan is going through his history. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just so powerful and moving. And then later on, when the Silk Spectre realizes that the comedian is her father, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that was just such gripping writing and just such such an added layer of complexity to these people. You had the material in between the chapters that told about how during the 40s you kind of gave like a very humanistic aspect to the whole superhero craze.
And the material that was in between was actually from the first Night Owl's book. I think his name was Hoggis.
Yeah.
There was like chapters from his book.
Let me throw one other thing in there before I let Ian talk about this, is the fact there's another place in the series that was particularly gripping is when Rorschach realizes what's happened to the kidnapped girl. When he looks, and they don't make it as obvious as it would later be in the movie, but there are these two German shepherds fighting over these bones, and suddenly Rorschach looks to see this chopping block, and he sees this thing to chop it up with, and he looks back at the dogs are fighting over this bone. And all of a sudden, the way that Gibbons drew this one panel with his head slightly tilted back, you know that he realized what is happening. And again, this is another thing that in the 80s was unheard of. We never heard of such thing, or we never focused on such things. Killing a child, I mean, we'd never do that in a comic book. So this was another one of those things that was so very unusual. What's your take on that, Ian?
That was pretty dark, but basically, the little girl had been butchered and chopped up into little pieces, and the pieces have been thrown to the dogs. I seem to remember that's actually in a flashback when he's actually being examined by the psychologist in the prison. Mm-hmm. And that whole bit's in flashback. And it was, you know, it's quite disturbing. One of the most disturbing things I've actually come across in a comic book, other than the writings aside, it's that.
Let me ask you guys, because you guys both read him in trades. Do you remember when it was that you read it in trade, Gianluca?
It was years ago. I'm 33 years old, so back in like 87, 88, I was way too young to kind of read something like that. It wasn't until like after college that I started getting back into comics that I read it. And again, it was like I've heard so much good stuff about it and how you had to read it, and I did. It really, like I said, it opened my eyes in terms of where the genre can go.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Ian?
As I said at the top of the show, I read it last year. I read it a couple of years ago, about 6 months before the Watchmen movie came out.
Oh, so you hadn't read it before that?
No, not been near it before that. I only really started getting into comics around about 2008 anyway, so... Mm-hmm.
Well, let me do a couple final thoughts. The way that this was advertised, and we really had no idea what it was, the phrase we kept seeing over and over again was, "Who watches the Watchmen?" And that tried to tease us as to what's going on with this. Some stuff started to leak out about it, and once it hit, boy, it started to sell extremely well. Man, it just, so many people, the phrase was, if you're not reading Watchmen, you're just reading comics. And so all those kinds of things are just amazing, but it just picked up and picked up, and the farther it went along, the more and more people went. It was considered a commercial success, and its sales helped DC Comics briefly overtake Marvel for a short time, which is kind of interesting. The publishing schedule, of course, as it always does with these miniseries, ran into delays. They were close, but 3 issues had to be completed instead of 6 when Len Wein believed that was necessary. But after the series concluded, individual issues were collected and sold into the trade paperback form that people know about it today. And you're right, Gianluca. Frank Miller's Batman The Dark Knight Returns, which was out about the same time, this was considered like a golden era for the miniseries in comics because of those two books. Because we hadn't seen a contained story like that. We were used to monthly comics that didn't come to an end, and they had to keep going. One final thought I thought was kind of interesting. There's Bradford Wright described Watchmen as Moore's obituary for the concept of heroes in general and superheroes in particular. So putting the story in a contemporary sociological context, Wright wrote that the characters of Watchmen were Moore's admonition to those who trusted in heroes and leaders to guard the world's fate was a mistaken idea. He added that to place faith in such icons were to give up personal responsibilities to the Reagans, the Thatchers, and other watchmen of the world who were supposed to rescue us and perhaps lay waste to the planet in the process. Moore specifically stated in 1986 he was writing Watchmen not to be anti-American, but anti-Reaganism, specifically believing that at the moment a certain part of Reagan's America isn't scared. They think they're invulnerable, and he thought that was not the case, and he was trying to prove that they were mistaken on that. So with that, we'll conclude our discussion of the comic books. Okay, let's move to the Watchmen film, which came out in 2009. Ever since the Watchmen appeared in 1986, several producers have been trying to turn it into a film. But there were always discussions with Alan Moore, who didn't want that to happen, and other people who tried to get in the way of it. In the mid-2000s, that finally came to pass where they got permission to proceed. And Zack Snyder, who's working on Superman, The Man of Steel currently, is the person who put that together. Depending on who you talk to, some people really loved it and some people really hated it. It was a grave disappointment or a tremendous love letter to The Watchmen, depending on who you talk to. Now, you had various actors doing the different roles, but probably the one that stood out the most, and many people agree with this, was Jack Haley, who did Rorschach. The story behind him getting that role was that he actually wasn't being considered, but at home he put together a demo tape and sent it in to the producers. And the producers, once they took a look at it, decided they'd better give him a chance, and he ended up winning the part. Because he had a lot of the lines that were the most memorable, he often was considered the main character of the movie. Interestingly enough, like on the director's edition, who's the central character in the middle of the picture but Rorschach? So in many ways, he was considered the star of the film, even though he wasn't necessarily of the comic.
Rorschach's Journal, October 12th, 1985. Dog carcass in alley this morning. Tire tread on burst stomach. This city's afraid of me. I've seen its true face. The streets are extended gutters, and the gutters are full of blood. And when the drains finally scab over, all the vermin will drown. The accumulated filth of all their sex and murder will foam up around their waists. And all the politicians will look up and shout, "Save us." And I'll whisper, "No." All those liberals and intellectuals and smooth talkers. And all of a sudden, nobody can think of anything to say.
It came out in 2009. It was well-liked for the special effects, for the dark tone, and it was also well-liked because it integrated a lot of music and did some changes to it. But those changes also weren't well-received by some people. For example, at the end, there's a discussion in the comic between Ozymandias and Dr. Manhattan before he leaves the Earth, and he says he's going to create life on his own, and Ozymandias says something to the effect of, well, you know, at least it ended well. And Dr. Manhattan turns to him and says, "Ended? Nothing ever ends." And he leaves Ozymandias actually looking somewhat puzzled. In the film, what happens is he says this to Silk Spectre as he's about to leave the Earth. He doesn't say this to Ozymandias. And some people thought that really watered the whole situation down. Don't know why they made that change in the movie, but they did. The music was sort of quirky and hip-hop-ish, and so a lot of the things that were done in there were really interesting. It was also a longer movie because they tried to get as much of the book in as they could. Now, as we mentioned a little earlier, the animation part for the pirate comics was done separately and integrated into some versions of the movie, but it was not put into the theater version. So you could not see that unless you bought the completed version several months later. And it's still, depending on who you talk to, is a great comic book movie or a bad comic book movie. So why don't we start talking about what you guys think of that? Let's start with you, Ian. What did you think of the film?
I thought it was a pretty good movie. You can see why a lot of people criticised it. Another point that you missed out on was Rorschach, when he's going round to warn them all at the beginning, he actually goes along to warn Ozymandias, but in the film, they changed that so it was Night Owl that warned Ozymandias.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of changes that were made to it, and this is why some of the people were very unhappy with it. But the truth of the matter was, no property ever makes it from printed page to theater screen or even to television screen without having some changes made in it for whatever reason. So to expect that this was going to be exactly the same as the comic was probably unrealistic. But, you know, there are some folks still totally believed in this book and really wanted it to be like a movie version of the comic, as if you'd taken the frame by frame like Frank Miller did with Sin City and make it look exactly like the comic had been. But I just can't see how you ever would expect that out of a film. The one thing I didn't like about the movie was that there were places in the movie at which it really dragged. And Ian and I both watched it this afternoon. And when I got to certain places, I started to speed up a little bit. What did you think of it, John Luca?
I think on a certain respect that if you came in and you really loved The Watchmen, you really wanted to see an adaptation of it, I think it succeeds in certain respects. It's very visual. The intro alone is just super cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you're somebody who never read The Watchmen and you were going in there either to just find out about it or going in there thinking it was going to be like a Spider-Man kind of movie, I think it fails in that regard. I knew a lot of people who went to see the movie who never read the book, and they just couldn't get into it. They thought it was too long. They were confused by certain things that I guess if you read the book, you get a better understanding of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they just didn't enjoy it.
There's actually a certain webmaster of a site that Wayne used to work on, he actually hated the movie. But for whatever reason, I don't know, but he hated the movie. I remember him doing a review on it, and he was just spewing pure hatred and venom for, you know, The Watchmen, saying, "This is the worst movie ever made."
I don't care for Zack Snyder. I think he's overrated.
Mm-hmm. One of the criticisms of the film, and when I was watching the movie before we started to record, was how violent it was. You get a lot of sequences in there. Of course, you see in the comics when somebody blows apart, it's not quite as graphic as it is in the film. You know, there's Dr. Manhattan going through Vietnam. Basically, he puts his hand out and pew! These different Vietnamese soldiers running away are blowing the bits in front of us. But the thing that bothered me the most, and I actually had to fast forward when I got to it, was when Rorschach exacts his revenge on the killer of the young girl. In the book, we don't see things. It's left to our imagination to come up to it. Nothing is left to our imagination in the film. He takes this cleaver, and he just starts hammering away on the head of the guy. And clearly, it's a dummy. It's not somebody he's doing this to. But my stomach started to turn when I saw this. I mean, he just time and time and time again, he's hacking at this poor guy. Not that he was poor, but I just thought, you know, this is not the way to handle this situation, in my opinion. I guess even 30 years later, I still subscribe to the more superheroic ideal rather than watching Rorschach chop somebody's head into quarter round or something like that. But
I'd be eternally grateful that I didn't write the movie.
Well, you do it worse?
Yeah, I would have had him take the meat cleaver to the guy's dick, you know?
Oh, well, yes, that would have been an X-rated movie if you'd done that.
You know, repeat and go for the crotch with the meat cleaver.
What you're saying is you didn't find it all that violent, Ian.
It didn't bother me. I mean, I watched Spartacus Blood and Sand, which is far more violent than that, where you see people putting sword through the back of people's heads so it comes out the other side of the mouth and their jaw drops off, you know? Ooh. So it didn't bother me. I mean, I'm used to watching, you know, slasher horror films and stuff like that, so it didn't really bother me.
What about you, John? Did it bother you, or was it okay with you?
I'm not somebody who's bothered by violence. I had read the book. I did know what I was going to expect going into it. Yeah, I didn't have a problem. I had problems with other things, but I didn't have a problem with the violence.
Okay, well, that's a perfect opening for me to ask you, what were the other things you had problems with?
Okay, what I had a problem with, basically, I thought Ozymandias was miscast of all the guys. I think everybody else was perfect. But with him, in the comic book, he's like a Ken doll, very muscular, kind of like the picture of perfection. And in the movie, he just kind of looked nebbish a little bit, looked like the suit and the muscles on the breastplate were making up for a lack of physique. But, you know, it is important if you're playing a certain kind of character.
Kind of looked like one of those comic book geeks you see walking around the convention halls with the Batman t-shirt on that's got all the abdominal muscles drawn on.
You know, one of the things I'm trying to remember, and I don't remember in the book, if Ozymandias was supposed to be a closet homosexual. In the movie, they make it pretty clear that he is gay, because he's walking around, there's obviously, he's out in front of a gay bar in one of these parts, and he goes to talk with them like this is all, everything's great and normal. And I started to know he wore this really funny-looking purple jacket and all this other stuff, and I started looking and thinking, you know, they're really going way out of their way to make us know that he is gay. And I didn't get a chance to look for that in the comic. I don't remember them really making that such a big, clear point out of it. But, you know, I don't know if that was necessary, even if it was part of the comic. I think they overemphasized that too much. I think it would have been better had they done less of that and just made it that the smartest guy in the world, even though he was tremendously smart, as far as information goes, that doesn't mean he was wise. I would have much rather they had gone that route than make it this, here's this gay guy who wants to stop war at all costs, and he doesn't care how many millions die just to save billions. Right. He came across as, how could this guy ever be a hero, was the way that it turned out. He was much more clearly a villain in the film than he was to me in the comics. Did either of you guys get that same feeling?
Yeah, I felt another change that they made for the worse was during the one part in the book, you had Captain Metropolis trying to restart the Minutemen again with some new members and the comedian, and that all gets blown up in his face. Everyone's fighting, and the comedian basically just disrespects him. And in the film, they made it Ozymandias as that person trying to do that. Mm-hmm. I guess they wanted to simplify the story, but it just created an obvious motive for why he killed the comedian. Mm-hmm. And I think it took away from the richness of the story.
And one of the scenes in the film that's really interesting is the scenes in the Vietnam. They're pulling out and the pregnant girl comes up to the comedian and says, "Hey, you're staying, you've got my baby," and is this whole commotion, and the comedian shoots her in the head, basically, and Dr. Manhattan says stop and pulls him up on it, and the comedian more or less turns around and says, "Well, you're a hypocrite. You got all this power, you could have stopped me. You could have turned a bullet into something else. You could have stopped me." Mm-hmm. And the fact that you didn't just goes to show how detached you are from humanity.
Now, another thing that they did, too, was Night Owl was much chunkier, shall we say, in the book than he is in the movie. At the very beginning of the movie, he's got a little bit of weight on him, and that must have been added to him because when he starts to put the costume on, he is ready to rumble. I mean, he looks like a superhero in the costume. Or one of the things that made Night Owl an interesting character was that he could not do the physical things in the comics. He tries to go up against Ozymandias, and there's just no chance. You feel sorry for him about that. The interesting thing is, of course, Dr. Manhattan, who is the ultimate physique, basically, versus Night Owl, who can actually love Silk Spectre instead of being the physical attraction involved. That wins out in the end, which is something I really liked, and that was completely eradicated out of the movie. I was really disappointed that they took that out. But on the other hand, do you want a heavyset guy running around doing all these fighting sequences? Right. That probably wasn't something they didn't want to do for fear of having the guy drop over from a heart attack or something like that. So that was interesting to me. One of the things I have to say about the movie, one of the great things about this was the related product that they put out. There were some really great action figures that came out. The thing that I particularly enjoyed, and I still have, was they did Archie the Owl Ship, Archimedes.
Archie survived that.
Archie.
Oh, well, short for Archimedes, Marlin's pet owl. Stupid nickname.
They put out a roughly $200, $250 statue of the owl ship that they had available. And boy, at that time, I had a lot more money than I do now, and I was able to buy it. And no matter how I'm tempted, I do not want to get rid of that ship because I just love the owl ship. It's so unlike anything else in any kind of vehicle. Usually bird things have wings and stuff like that. It's like an oval shape with just the two owl eyes on the front. When they had the cast and the crew out in San Diego at the Comic-Con December 4th, they had the life-size representation of Archie in the San Diego Comic-Con. And you could get your picture taken inside the ship. And to this day, I regret that I didn't get there to get my picture taken in the ship. I would have loved to have had that. So that was one of the great things about it. You can't fault Warner Brothers for the publicity that they did with the film. They really went, head over heels trying to make this thing a success. When all said and done, it did okay because it was an expensive movie to make. I don't think that they're going to try to do another one. But it did well. It didn't do as well as they'd hoped, though. You're going to say something, Ian?
So you can talk about the marketing campaign. Bloody hell. We were getting viral marketing stuff on Sci-Fi Pulse, the website, pretty much most of the way through 2007, definitely for the last 6 months of 2007, and the intervening 3 or 4 months leading up to the actual movie's release. Mm-hmm. Always getting sent all sorts of marketing stuff to actually put up on Pulse, including a viral video. It's incredible.
Did that bother you? Was that overkill, do you think, or do you think they were doing the right thing?
I feel when they do stuff like that, for most things it would be overkill, but I think with Watchmen, I think up until that point, Watchmen was very inclusive to only those that have read comics, so I can see the reasons for them having such a marketing campaign there, because they were trying to hook in people that haven't read the book before to go see the film. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, it made sense, but for any other film, a marketing campaign like that would be over the top for me, to be honest.
Now, one of the things I thought was worth mentioning was that I thought the special effects were particularly good in the film. The action sequences had a little bit of Matrix involved with it. Sometimes they would go really slow, and sometimes they go really fast, and the effects were good. I mean, Dr. Manhattan, I mean, even to the point where we see his family jewels in there, it's just, this is the way it was in the book. I mean, this was extremely accurate to the comic. And the way I understood they do is they wired the actor completely up with computer sensors, and they basically translated him into a CGI character.
And they drew Wingy on there.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's just say that Dr. Manhattan's not going to produce any progeny anytime soon based on what we can see. But I just thought the effects on him were amazing. In the comics, they have these multiple Manhattans doing different things. When they walk into each other on the movie screen, I thought that was a really cool effect. I thought that the way they did his eyes with the reversal, that the cornea is actually the lightest part of the eye, I thought that was really cool. I just thought that the way they did particularly Dr. Manhattan was spectacularly well done as far as CGI goes.
Yeah.
The music is way urban kind of feel to it. You have a lot of pop music that's into it, but there are also these, it almost sounds like hip-hop to me, the way that the background music sounds. So I like those things. I think those were really kind of cool. I don't know what that was had to do with in the 80s, though. Since it was based in the 80s, I don't think there was hip-hop around
that
time.
Yeah, it was. In the 80s.
Oh, was there?
It was kind of, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Like
well, then.
Rap, but
yeah, but those were kind of things I thought were good. Any other things that we should say about the film before we wrap up on that?
Could have done without the overly long owl ship sex scene.
Oh, yeah. That was a little long, wasn't it?
It goes on for such a long time.
Well, I think what they're doing is this song takes a long time. They're going to play every precious second of that Hallelujah song and on and on and on it goes. And I have to say, when I remember sitting in the theater, I really started to get uncomfortable after a while.
Yeah, it is after a while. You know, the first few minutes, I guess, is okay. But then you're getting up there in time and you're just like, okay, I get it. They're having sex.
We get this part. Let's move on.
Yeah.
You hardly see anything. I mean, let's face it, it was all done in very dark shadow, so you didn't really get to see that much. But I was kind of like the same. By the end of it, I was going, hallelujah.
Hallelujah wasn't about the sex part. It was that sequence being over. Well, what did you guys think of the costumes, though? I mean, compared to Dave Gibbons' original costumes, did any one of them good, bad, indifferent?
I liked it a lot. I felt it was very true to the book, especially the CGI effects with Rorschach's face moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that stands out to me the most.
Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of Night Owl, so I like the Night Owl costume. I actually liked it better than the one that Dave Gibbons did. The Night Owl costume in the comic has a rounded bottom under this cape that attaches to his head, and I always thought that was a mistake. They did a much more Batman-like costume in the sense that the cape hangs from his shoulders. He's got an owl-like helmet on that points to Batman-like ears. So I like those. The Silk Spectre's outfit I thought was kind of cool. I really like that. Dr. Manhattan, I have to go back to that, was just ripped right out of the books. Those were just,
yeah.
I mean, God, that was exactly the way they appeared in the books. They didn't make any changes to that. And I thought that was definitely one of the strengths of the film.
I thought they did a good job of recreating the prison break scene. That was a very fun part of the movie that was accurate to the book. And the CGI on Mars was great, too.
My favorite line, you know, one of my favorite lines is actually in the prison scene when Rorschach is actually challenged by one of the prisoners. And he goes, I'm not in here with you. You're in here with me.
None of you seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me.
Yeah, that was a good one. That was, again, see, Rorschach got all these juicy lines, and the actor just delivered them with such verve that I came out of the movie going, that was the Rorschach movie. He was the main guy in this. I love the fact when he has to go into the bathroom, and the door swings back and forth a couple of times, and we start to see what he's about to do. He's not going in there to relieve himself. He's going in there to take care of the dwarf guy. And, you know, at the end we leave, and unlike the comic, too, it goes back and we see blood coming under the door, which is not the way it was done in the comic, but I thought that was actually better in there. That's our discussion of the movie.
Hey, everybody, this is Nick Tarabay, Asher, and Spartacus, Gods of the Arena, Spartacus, Blood and Sand, and the new Spartacus as well. And I'm here at SFP Now. Keep listening and keep watching. Thank you so much.
Okay, now let's get to the juicy part of the discussion. This has to do with DC Entertainment's recent announcement of a Before Watchmen event. On February the 1st, David Hyde from DC Comics put out a release that DC Entertainment will publish all new stories expanding on the acclaimed Watchmen universe. As highly anticipated as they are controversial, the 7 interconnected prequel miniseries will build on the foundation of the original Watchmen, the best-selling graphic novel of all time. Before Watchmen will be the collective banner for all 7 titles from DC Comics. Now, the 7 books that are going to come out are going to be Rorschach, and there's going to be 4 issues of that, written by Brian Azzarello and drawn by Lee Bermejo from the Joker fame. Yep. Then there's going to be Minutemen, a 6-issue miniseries written and drawn by Darwin Cook. Then Brian Azzarello returns to write The Comedian, and he's going to have J.G. Jones providing the art. Dr. Manhattan is written by J. Michael Straczynski, who thinks he's Dr. Manhattan, with art by Adam Hughes. Speaking of J. Michael Straczynski, he's going to be writing Night Owl, unfortunately, which is going to be 4 issues long, and it's going to have Andy and Joe Kubert on the art, so the art might save that one. Ozymandias is going to be 6 issues long, and he's going to have Len Wein writing and Jay Lee drawing a DC comic for the first time, I believe. So that'll be something interesting. Silk Spectre has Darwin Cook back on her, and 4 issues that'll be, with a perfectly appropriate choice for artist, Amanda Connor. I think she'll do a wonderful job on that. Each week a new issue will be released and will feature a 2-page backup story called Curse of the Crimson Corsair, which will be written by the series editor Len Wein with art by original series colorist John Higgins. There'll also be a single issue Before Watchmen epilogue featuring the work of various writers and artists and a Crimson Corsair story by Wein and Higgins in it. The original series of Watchmen is the complete story that Alan Moore and I wanted to tell. However, I appreciate DC's reasons for this initiative and the wish of the writers and artists involved to pay tribute to our work. May these new additions have the success they deserve, said Dave Gibbons. Comic books are perhaps the largest and longest-running form of collaborative fiction, said DC's Dan DiDio and Jim Lee. Collaborative storytelling is what keeps these fictional universes current and relevant. Now, as I understand that these are going to be out in the summer, as we talked about. So let's start off with you, Gianluca. What's your impression when you first heard about this?
There had been hints about it before, but DC had been pretty good at keeping specifics under wraps. It sounds exciting. Obviously, that's the goal of it. Brian Azzarello, I'm a really big fan of his, and he's paired with a couple of really great artists in each book. Besides the Joker reteaming with Lee Bermejo, Lee Bermejo also did that Batman Noel book as well.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And J.G. Jones, I'm a big fan of his work. You mostly see him do like a lot of amazing cover work. You don't see him do a lot of interiors, so this is going to be a welcome change, seeing that. Mm-hmm. And then my other favorite, I guess, is going to be Darwin Cook writing and drawing Minutemen.
Yeah, I'm a big Darwin Cook fan as well, so I'm really looking forward to that. Ian, what was your response when you heard about it?
I'm kind of like on the fence. I'd be interested to have a look at the Minutemen. One, because that's part of the thing in Watchmen that we only really, even in the film and in the comic, it's referred to, but, you know, I hate to say it, but it sounds more interesting than what's actually going on in the Watchmen versus the Minutemen.
Okay.
We all started.
Okay.
But the fact that JMS is involved with it, big turn off.
Yeah, well, you have to get in line behind me on that one. But I want to bring up a couple of criticisms that came out about this series, and we can talk about them. The first criticism I heard about this was that in San Diego last year, and I heard him say this, that DC was not going to be doing any special events for the next year. Now, of course, this is going to be coming out during the summer. If he waits until after the San Diego Comic-Con, he'll have been correct. But there are a lot of people taking him to task for saying something like that and then changing his mind on that. Now, the truth of the matter is, in my mind, that people can change their minds 8 months after you make an announcement. And if you've got something really big and you realize that your new 52 has taken off, is doing really well, and you can possibly even do better with a popular property like Watchmen, of course he's going to do something like this during the summer. He's going to try to mute the Avengers versus X-Men as much as he can. So as far as this goes, it doesn't bother me that they've changed the company line regarding this several months after it's been said by Dan DiDio, who takes it on the chin a lot from fans. He really gets pounded by the fans a lot, and sometimes I don't think it's necessarily justified. But that was one of the criticisms I heard. Ian, did that bother you at all?
Not really, because it was 8 months ago, so it's almost a year ago. And by the time the actual comics come out, it will be a year ago.
Okay, Gianluca?
In terms of that, no, I didn't have any problem with that kind of criticism. You're in the business of trying to sell comic books.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's get to one of the big criticisms, and that is Alan Moore's criticism. He refers to what DC is doing as evil. And the reason why he refers to what they're doing as evil is because he was promoting another work that he was doing, and somebody asked him about, should DC be doing this? And somebody was pointing out to him that in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, he had taken other literary characters and incorporated them into his work. Jules Verne, he had taken works out of H. Rider Haggard, Bram Stoker, Jules Verne, and used a lot of characters that these people had made, like Dracula, and put them into The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And when asked what the difference is, this is what Alan Moore said. In literature, I would say that it's different because while others may say it's splitting hairs, I'm not adapting these characters. I'm doing an adaptation of Dracula or King Solomon's mind. What I am doing is stealing them. There's a difference between doing an adaptation, which is evil, and actually stealing the characters, which as long as everybody's dead or you don't mention the names, is perfectly all right by me. I'm not trying to be glib here. I genuinely do feel that literature, you have a great tradition that goes back to Jason and the Argonauts of combining literary characters. It's just irresistible to do these fictional mashups, he said. They've been going on for hundreds of years, and I feel I'm part of a proud literary tradition doing what I'm doing. With taking comics characters that have been created by cheated old men, I feel that's different, and that's my take on the subject. Ian, why don't you respond to that?
I'm just trying to figure out what drugs he was doing on that day. It seems to be really odd justification saying that he's not taking advantage of those properties in order to do this mashup, even though it may be a proud tradition. I mean, so like Sherlock Holmes versus Dracula, Sherlock Holmes versus zombies, as Ian Edgington's done. The advantage is he's actually doing characters there that are out of copyright anyway. Nobody actually owns them. I just think a lot of it with Moore is he's bitter, really, because dealings with DC and Marvel, for the record, haven't been that great. He feels that he was screwed over. And perhaps he was, but life goes on. Mm-hmm. Get over it.
Uh-huh. How about you, Gianluca?
Yeah, you know, lately Alan Moore has come across as kind of a grump. The thing is that there was a deal with Watchmen where if the book was ever to go out of print, the rights would go to him and Dave Gibbons. But the book never went out of print. You know, DC makes sure that it stays in print. So, you know, I guess he's a little bit bitter about that. But at the same time, this is an original concept that he did. But the characters themselves weren't really original either. You know,
right,
they were
right.
Belonging to DC. He just right. did variations of them.
Right.
I'm not really surprised about it. To me, I don't see any problem with DC bringing this back. The property is as popular as it ever was. I'm kind of surprised they didn't do it maybe around the time of the movie, but whatever, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you guys think about Dave Gibbons' support? I read his response that was in the news release that went out. A lot of people have said that it's a tepid one. He's basically saying, well, it's okay if they do it, but he doesn't sound terribly excited about that. Do you get that from what he's saying, Gianluca?
He's been a big supporter of the Watchmen being done in various things. I remember when the movie went out, he was a big supporter of that because he was credited in the film, and he probably got some money out of that as well, too. It definitely created renewed interest in his work as well. So I'm not really surprised. When they were originally talking about doing the Before Watchmen, I thought he was going to have, like, art involvement in some way, and maybe he will some way. So he's not wanting to burn any bridges. So,
mm-hmm. Well, he's got money to be made out of here. If you're Dave Gibbons, I wouldn't be one that's turned down the money. Mr. Moore's name wasn't anywhere on the Watchmen film, and may or may not be on these books when they come forward. Ian, what do you think?
Given that he's refused to have his name attached to any of the films and prophecies, can't see his name being on the books, as you say. He probably doesn't want anything to do with it.
One of the criticisms was that it took 25 years for them to be able to put out this prequel. And some people are saying, well, that's a good thing because they waited until they had the right pool of talent to pull together. Other people are saying it's a good thing because it's part of the 25th anniversary celebration of The Watchmen. Other people are saying that this is just their attempt to utilize these characters for their own ill-gotten gain. That they're trying to, as I said before, they're trying to mute Marvel or trying to overtake Marvel. And by using The Watchmen in this way, they are making less of the characters. Does that argument carry any weight with either of you guys?
To me, it doesn't, because The Watchmen is standalone. There's nothing really you could do to butcher that book. They're short miniseries. It's just like an extra way that if you really enjoyed Watchmen, what else can I read regarding these characters? It just gives somebody another option.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
Prequels are kind of in fashion right now.
Mm-hmm.
I reckon now is as good a time to do a prequel as any. They're kind of fashionable. I mean, and it's better than the alternative, a complete reboot.
Because Star Wars had a prequel. I mean, all these other shows have had prequels, and movies have come out and gone before because they want to try to show how things got the way they are. And some people really like that.
I think the advantage that Watchmen has over Star Wars, and Star Wars it's sort of alluded to sort of thing. We don't actually see anything of it. But at least in Watchmen, there's documentation of it. In the film, you see little flashbacks to it right at the start of the film. As well as during the film sort of thing. So Watchmen has a huge advantage over a lot of these other properties in that the prequel stuff is already in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons that I'd say that out of the books that they are doing, I'm probably more inclined to go for the Minutemen. I'll probably go for that when it trades. I'll not get it as a monthly or weekly or whatever.
When Darwin Cook does a book like that, he always gets my full attention. He's doing the Parker books right now, for example, and they are just wonderful to read. He designed the opening sequence for Batman Beyond, answered a newspaper ad that Bruce Timm had put out there trying to get someone to do that. And his career has just flown ever since then. And he hasn't done a bad thing yet. Justice League New Frontier, all kinds of wonderful things that he's done. He even did some art in The Shade recently, which was one of the new 52 miniseries going on. One last criticism that people are putting out, and this is probably going to carry the least weight of any of them, was that when Mr. Straczynski finished off with Superman Grounded, not one of the high points of his career, to be honest, he came out and said that he was no longer going to do ongoing comics and he was going to take a sabbatical for 1 to 5 years. Now, it's going to run, depending on which part of the summer this hits, it's going to hit just about exactly a year since he said that. And so some people are really saying, you said you weren't going to do this. And, you know, well, you know, truth be told, Mr. Straczynski is a terrible liar. That man lies like a horse thief. So the fact that people are surprised that he's going back on what he said, if you've ever read what this guy talks about, this man, he never tells the truth. So why in the world you'd be upset about this, I can't figure. But I don't know. I know Ian probably doesn't care, and Gianluca, I don't know whether that means anything to you either.
You know, if those guys are going to start paying him to sit at home, then they have the right to talk. But he doesn't earn a living. Screw them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I was watching TV the other day and happened to be an episode of Murder, She Wrote that was on the air, and it was actually written by JMS.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be one.
Oh, wow.
How is he going to fit Angela Lansbury into his Watchmen books, you know? Let's figure out how that's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, let me hit on a couple of things that I'm looking forward to as far as the books. You guys can chime in, too. One of the great things about the covers that they've released is that the layout resembles the original Watchmen layout. On the left-hand side of the cover, turned 90 degrees up, is the name of the character that the book is based on and where the word Watchmen had appeared before. There's a lot of use of black and yellows. Even in the company logo, they're using the one that was specifically designed for the Watchmen. So I kind of think that's cool. I like that about it. The choice of the talent, now they didn't pull in Jeff Johns, which I would have liked, or some of the other people. There are a lot of other people they could have pulled in, but the people that they did pull in I thought were really high power talent. And so I'm looking forward to all of these, just like I did with the new 52. I'm planning to buy all of these. JMS. Well, those ones I'll buy with.
Yeah.
I'll read with one eye open. But the other thing I think is smart is to put this out sometime during the summer. Summer is a well-known time for people, like kids who are out of college or out of school. They've got a little disposable income. What do? They frequent the comic shop. So this is a chance to be able to get people to buy it. Now, granted, kids may not have read The Watchmen. The younger readers may not have actually read The Watchmen to this point. But if that's the case, this is the perfect time to get them into The Watchmen by giving them the trade of the original series. So for me, I think it's well-timed. You've got the new 52 is doing extremely well. This is their chance to deliver another punch on Marvel, to keep being competitive with Marvel and to change the landscape of the comics industry. So when I heard about it, I was very encouraged by that. What things are you looking forward to, Gianluca?
Well, I mentioned before, I'm looking forward to Minutemen, Rorschach, and the Comedian. Brian Azzarello is a great writer. The teams and the characters kind of influence what I want to get. Like, I want to get definitely Rorschach and Comedian, based on that, the teams involved. And same with Minutemen, since Darwin Cook is writing and drawing it. Ozymandias, I like Len Wein, but I just don't care enough about the character. So it's kind of interesting.
So you'll be not likely to buy them all. You'll kind of pick and choose.
I may get them all in a trade, or if they collect all the trades into one big trade, I'm likely to get that. I'm willing to get, though, three of those as a monthly.
Okay. How about you, Ian?
Most interested in the Minutemen, but like John Mooker, I'm probably going to get a trade. I'm not going to invest in buying them over the summer.
Well, I guess it falls to me, as usual, to buy them all. I'm going to go out there, just like I did with the New 52, and buy them all.
You can buy my copies and John Mooker's copies.
Well, I'll do is I'll have to. I'll tell you, I'll buy the digital copies, and we'll just sort of quietly share them around amongst each other. By the way, DC does not send out PDF copies, I found out recently. They don't do the things like Boom and Dynamite and other companies do. They only send out actual copies to a few outlets, which means likely I'm not going to get any of those, much as I would love to, but I think overall, this is a good move on DC's part. I think it's smart to take such a popular property and do a little more with it while being respectful to what's already happened. Do you have any last words on this?
The more we know about the Before Watchmen, the more we can talk about it later. But this is all we know so far.
Right. Okay, and we'll be talking a lot more about this in the future. So thanks, you guys, for talking with me about Watchmen.
Cool.
Awesome. Yay.
I hope you enjoyed the first thematic episode that'll appear occasionally here on Wayne's Comics. We'll provide a variety of topics to discuss, and we'll maybe bring in some new people too, just to provide some varying points of view. Next week, be sure to be here. I'll have a great interview with Jeff Lemire, the writer behind Animal Man, the creator of Sweet Tooth, and the writer who's taking over Justice League Dark. But until then, keep reading your comics.
Keep your own secrets.
Rorschach!
Wait. Never compromise. Not even in the face of Armageddon. That's always been the difference between us, Daniel.